Okay, so let's get started. Just a reminder that the due date for the first project is coming up. Okay, everyone who has declared a project group should be in the auto grader system. I don't know how many of you have actually used it so far. Other than one email I received where there was a problem which I fixed, I don't know if others have started using it and you've gotten feedback from the auto grader. Works okay? Alright, so if you have any problems using the auto grader, let me know. I would encourage you to try it out as soon as possible, just to make sure you're set up properly, you get back an automated graded response for your submission and so on. Okay? You don't want to discover at the last minute that something is wrong. Okay, is that clear? So let us know if there's any problems. There were a few of you who hadn't formed a group. Okay? And at the discussion section yesterday, you mentioned who are the people. And so I would encourage you to talk to one another, see if you can come to some agreement, form a group, and send me that information ASAP so I can enter you into the system. If you haven't yet formed a group or you haven't told us what your group is, you are not in the system, which means you cannot submit your project. Okay, so it's important that you tell us something so we have you in the system in the right way. Okay, even if you decide to work on your own, you do need to let us know so we can enter you into the system. Okay, as a group of one. Okay? Yes, your question.
Did you fill out the paperwork yesterday or you in the system?
If you filled out that in-class exercise, I took all of that information and we have entered it into the system. So you should be in. Okay, which is why I said try it out. Send out a submission today. See if you get an automated reply saying this is, we received the submission and get back a graded response. That tells you you are in the system. If you do not get an email back within, let's say, 10-15 minutes, then something is wrong. You are not in the system. Okay, so that's something you should check.
So the email gets sent to all everybody in the group?
I think it goes to everybody. It goes to your EdLab account. Okay, so make sure that you either put a dot forward in your EdLab account to forward it to wherever you check your email, or you check your EdLab email. The responses go to your EdLab account. Yes, question.
Actually, for my submission, it took about half an hour
okay.
to respond.
So. Okay. So, I mean, the auto grader actually sends out an email in less than a minute after it receives your submission, but mail servers may queue it up for whatever reason, so it may take a while to hear back. Okay, but so long as you get it within half an hour, let's say, you should be okay. Okay, typically it shouldn't take that long, but sometimes it may. Okay, yes, question there.
What if you were to submit more than once? If you didn't get the email back in an hour, but there was some reason why, there was some reason you submitted again, would you get an email saying that you've already submitted?
Yeah, so you can, as you remember, there was this three bonus submissions that you are allowed, which means you are submit once a day, but you can up for three of those days, or you can submit more, three more times than your 1 day limit over the course of that project. Okay, so you can do that, but if you do that, you are using up one of your bonus points. That's all. And so as after you use them up all, then you will not hear back. The other thing, as far as I remember, is it basically if you do multiple submissions, it somehow, I need to check, it will probably send you one graded response or something like that. I need to look into that. Okay, but you are allowed to submit more than once, that's not a problem. But if you don't hear back, it's better to ask me why you didn't hear back. Okay, rather than waste one more attempt and one chance to submit. Because you should hear back, that's what the system is supposed to do. Okay, so do that. Any other questions here? Okay. So, do try it out. Let us know, let us as in Shashi or me know if there's any problem and we'll fix it. Okay. So now coming back to the lecture, where we left off last time was this notion of, I introduced the notion of a process. I said what is a process, what are the data structures, maintained in the kernel for each process in the system. How do you create processes? How do you terminate processes? So we have looked at all of that. Okay. So the next subtopic here is this notion of cooperating processes. Okay. Now if you are given any two processes on a system, okay, take any two arbitrary processes, they will either be independent or cooperating. If these processes have nothing to do with one another, they don't communicate, they are just doing their own things, they are said to be independent, okay, meaning that they don't have any common task or common goal to achieve. Okay. Otherwise, these two processes are said to be cooperating. They are cooperating with one another to achieve some common goal. They may be part of a larger application. Okay. They may be interacting with one another to do something. Okay. So, cooperating processes work with each other to achieve some single task. Okay. And what these processes can do is they can improve performance by overlapping activities or doing things in parallel. Okay. There are many instances of applications that are written that use multiple processes. Okay. Apache web servers, if you look at the Google's Chrome browser, they all use architectures that make use of multiple processes to achieve some common task. Okay. Now, what that also gives you when you have multiple processes that are part of an application is what is called a distributed system. Okay. Also, in certain cases, you can classify this further as a parallel system, okay, which we'll come back to later. And this is how many modern applications are written. Okay. And we will look at several instances throughout the course of this semester as to how you can write more complicated applications using multiple processes or multiple threads. Threads are concepts that we'll look at in today's class. Now, here is a canonical example of cooperating processes. These are called producers and consumers. Okay, many, many applications that you encounter use some variant of this. Okay. So, what happens in this case is there are two processes, okay, in this simple example. One is called a producer, the other one is called a consumer. Okay. The producer process produces some data, okay, and it then hands it over to the consumer. Consumer process consumes this data and processes it. Okay? That's the basic idea. The producer is producing data and the consumer is consuming this data. Okay? Now, as you can imagine, there has to be a way for the producer to take any data it has produced and hand it over to the consumer. Okay? And that is where the cooperation comes in. Okay? There has to be this mechanism to hand this data. And there are two ways you can do this. Okay? One is called message passing, and the other one is called shared memory. Okay? The example on this slide shows you how to implement a simple producer, single consumer type application using shared memory. Okay? What is this notion of shared memory? So you will see what is the producer doing. Okay, basically produce a data item and you stick it into a buffer. Then you are just making sure the buffer isn't full. Okay, because this is assumed to be the buffer is basically an array of some fixed length, and so long as it doesn't full, the producer can keep adding data items to the buffer. If the buffer is full, meaning all the slots in this array are occupied, then it has to wait. Okay? So it cannot just produce more data items. It will have to wait until some of those slots get freed up by the consumer. Okay? And the consumer is basically looking at the buffer and just taking items out of this buffer. And again, if the buffer is empty, it has to wait for some data item to be produced. It cannot consume if there is nothing in the buffer. Okay? So these checks prevent what are called either buffer overflows or buffer underflows. Buffer overflow is preventing you from overwriting the buffer. Buffer underflow prevents you from doing anything if the buffer is empty. Okay? Now this buffer, think of it as a circular buffer. Okay? So rather than thinking of it as a linear array, you can think of it as a circular buffer, and the producer is basically adding data items, and the consumer, so these are items that are in the buffer and these are free slots. Okay. So the producer, as it keeps adding, it's incrementing the index. Yeah, so basically if it adds a data item, it just moves its pointer, the in variable moves here, and the out tells you what's the tail of this buffer. I mean, it's like a queue. which is implemented as a circular buffer, and you keep consuming from the tail, and the producer is adding to the head of the buffer. Okay. And the mod allows you to do wraparound. This is just basically a simple array, but you can wrap around and go back to the beginning of the array and keep adding. That's what the mod is doing. Okay. Now this is using shared memory. The reason you have shared memory is this buffer is shared between these two processes. Okay, it's a piece of memory that two independent processes that were independent are now sharing, and they are cooperating with one another. Okay. I haven't shown you how to actually implement shared memory. But for now, let's assume that this buffer is shared between two processes. So both processes can access this array. Okay? And then the producer just adds items and the consumer takes items out of this array. Okay? Any questions here?
And the in versus out.
Sorry?
And the in versus out comparison?
Yes, the in and out are also shared variables, because you can see that these two variables need to be accessed by both processes. Yeah, what's the question?
I just quickly wanted to kind of step through, you know, why they can't use the same equality condition or the same condition.
Why can they not use the same condition?
See the while loop test?
Yes. So basically what the producer is doing is making sure that it has not overflown the buffer. What the consumer needs to do is to make sure the buffer is not empty. So these are two different conditions, right? The producer, basically, if the buffer is full, consumer has to consume some of these data items to empty these slots, and then the producer can add more items. So it has to make check. The check that the producer is doing is to make sure all the slots are not full. What the consumer needs to do is to make sure all the data items are not, I mean, the buffer is not empty, that there is something to consume. If the buffer is empty, it has to wait. Okay? So that is the reason there are different conditions. Okay, yes, question.
Just to make sure I was reading the source code, next C is the next consumer in the consumer queue, and next P is the next producer.
Yes, exactly.
So this isn't just one producer, one consumer, this applies to n producer, n consumer.
Okay, that's a good point. I mean, I actually just said for simplicity, you have to assume that there's one producer process and one consumer process. But the producer-consumer problem is a general problem where you can have arbitrary number of producers, arbitrary number of consumers. Okay? When we talk about synchronization, we'll actually come back to this. Okay? Because you have to do things like locking in order to implement this properly, which I have not shown here at all. Okay, so this code will not work as is. First of all, this is pseudo code, it's not real code. But this code is not going to work as is without synchronization. And that's the next topic, we haven't really looked at it. Okay? So in the general case, you can have arbitrary number of producers and consumers. For the purposes of this class, let's just assume there's one of each. Okay? That's the simplest case. Single producer, single consumer problem. Yes.
So you're saying this is shared memory because we have one common variable buffer?
Yes. So if you think about it, the way we are looking at this, producer is one process in the system. Okay, consumer is some other process in the system. Okay. Now the producer has to produce some data and hand it to the consumer. Okay. How do you do that? Right. So what we say is there's this region of memory that becomes, typically if you have two independent processes, they cannot really access each other's memory address spaces. Their address spaces are assumed to be only accessible by themselves and no one else. So you can't just poke around at some other process's address space. Okay, it's because the OS is not going to let you do that. Okay. So in order to do this, there's an abstraction called shared memory. And this is explicitly for sharing a region of memory across multiple processes. So if you create shared memory, and we'll look at what are the system calls to do this, then you have a region of memory that is basically the same region. So think of it as the producer process ends here and the consumer process begins here. So this region of memory is accessible to both. Okay, so you are basically adding data items here and this one is taking it out. Okay, that's what is happening here. Okay, any other questions? What shared memory concept is? Okay. Same problem, different solution. Okay, this is the producer-consumer problem using message passing. In message passing, there is no notion of shared memory. Okay, like I just showed you here, you'll assume that producer and consumers are independent processes, and the way the producer is actually going to send over a data item to the consumer is through this notion of a message. Okay? And so you have here as a primitive called send and a primitive called receive. Okay? So what the producer is effectively doing here is it produces a data item, okay, stores it in NextP, and it sends this data item over to the consumer. Okay, that essentially means it basically sends off a message. Okay, the message goes off to the consumer, and the consumer can receive that data item using this notion of a receive. Okay, so is that clear? What message passing effectively means you're sending messages back and forth. Okay, and you're communicating with one another using the notion of messages. In the previous case, you are still communicating implicitly using a shared memory region. Okay, there was no explicit communication, that was implicit. Here you have explicit communication. Okay, sending messages over a network uses the exact same idea. Okay, well, this is basically sending messages between two processes. Okay, now the way this is internally implemented, okay, by the OS is that what the OS is going to do, so these are two processes. Okay, when this process sends a message to that other process, this message basically goes and sits into a kernel buffer. Okay, and when this consumer does a receive, then this data is actually handed over to the consumer. Okay, that's how message passing is actually implemented within the OS kernel. Okay, if you use socket communication or anything like this, okay, to do any sort of network programming, that is effectively what is happening underneath the covers. Okay. Networking allows you to send a message to a process on some other machine. Okay, we will come back to this when we talk about distributed system. Here you are sending messages between two processes that reside on the same machine. The way this is implemented is when you do this send, you take this buffer and you make a copy of it in the kernel. Okay, and the kernel stores it. And when you do a receive here, then basically the kernel hands off that buffer to you, and then you get that data item. And this is how you are communicating. Is this clear? Any questions on this? Yes.
So the kernel buffer is in memory.
Yes, the kernel buffer is in memory, except that, yes, it is in memory, but it's a kernel address, within the kernel address space.
Okay, and then so is there, how would we be able to determine the max for overflow?
Yes, that's a good question, right? So here I didn't show you anything about overflows and underflows. Okay, the assumption is you can, if you actually wrote this as while one and you kept sending data, the consumer didn't receive any of this data, eventually the kernel buffer is going to fill up. Okay? There isn't an explicit limit we have set here. At some point the kernel is going to give you an error when you try to do a send because it ran out of resources. Okay? So in the previous case we had what is called a bounded producer consumer, where we have explicitly put a size limit on the amount of data you can have in transit. Okay, that's the size of the buffer. In this case, we actually didn't put any explicit limit, but the kernel has some limits. It depends on how much memory you have on your machine. At some point, it's going to have resource exhaustion, and this call is going to fail. Okay? So, but you can actually have additional logic that says, I'm not going to have more than so many of these data items in transit, which the receiver hasn't received and so on. Yes.
Can I just trap the error and then just wait till there is room?
Yes, you can absolutely trap the error and block for some time and keep sending. That's what you would have to do. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so the other thing I didn't mention is there's a fork there. That's the parent process. The parent process, what's happening here is you do a fork, the parent becomes the producer, and the child implements the consumer. Okay, that's effectively how we are implementing this. But what the primitive that we are using are the send and receive primitives, which implement message passing. Okay. So that's the point that was just raised, saying if you had a bounded buffer, then you would need this in and out variables, which I didn't show. In this case, we are assuming that the OS has plenty of memory and the producer is never going to overflow. Okay? But you, in reality, you would have to either put an explicit limit or make it, at least check whether your send has succeeded or not. And the same is true for the receiver. The receiver is not checking for any underflow here. Okay, so basically what would happen is if the buffer, if there was this queue, this is essentially a queue. Okay, so as the producer produces data, it goes to the head of the queue. Every time you do a receive, you're rather to the tail of the queue. And every time you do a receive, you take an item from the head and the receive returns. Okay. If that queue is empty, okay, we have not checked whether the queue is empty in this case. If the queue is empty, then what happens is this becomes a blocking call. It just blocks until some data item becomes available and then it returns. Okay, this is why you don't have to do an explicit check for buffer underflow, because this is always is called a blocking receive, meaning that you will wait until the producer actually sends data. You are not going to do anything. Okay. You could have a non-blocking version of receive. Okay. There are some things like non-blocking receives. So if the buffer is empty, if the queue is empty, then the non-blocking version would basically return an error saying there is nothing to receive. Okay. In this case, you would wait and then retry after some time. So you can have either a blocking or a non-blocking version. Okay. Yes, question there.
Is there a proxy ID that goes into the buffer with the shared data so that the receive knows which data to pull from,
yes,
other things in the buffer?
Good question, right? So question is, how do you know which queue to receive from? There may be many processes that are all interacting with one another. So we basically have, in the send, we tell who the recipient is. And when you do the received, you say who the sender was. Otherwise, you will not know, right, which queue to receive from. So that is the reason you have to specify these two things. Okay? Is that clear? Any other questions here? Okay. So there is a question here. How do you implement message passing where you have single producer, multiple consumer, or you could also have multiple producers, multiple consumer. So think about this. We are going to come back to producers and consumers when we do synchronization. Okay? Because this is not really the right way to do it. You have to have additional at least in shared memory, you need additional synchronization primitives. So when we come back to it, we'll see how to generalize it. But for now, you could do this as a sort of thought exercise as to how to go about doing this. Okay, so the other thing to keep in mind is each process needs to be able to name the other process. Okay, in order to say who to send a message and who should I receive the message from. Okay, that was this notion of a consumer and producer. Okay, so what are the OS level primitives in order for you to implement these things? Okay, so first let's look at shared memory. Okay, what does the shared, so to implement a shared memory region, you have to first do a few things. Okay, so suppose that there's a producer and there's a consumer. Okay, they are initially, when you start them off, they are not going to share any memory region. If you want to implement producer-consumer using shared memory, they're not going to share anything. So you have to explicitly do something in order for them to share a memory region. Okay. And there are several calls available to do this. Okay. MMAP is one, but there are others, and I'll show you two or three examples. So there is something called shared memory get. Okay. That's a system call that you have on any Unix-like operating system. There's another call called shared memory attach. Okay. SHMAT. Then there is one called MMAP. Okay. You could use some combination of these to achieve what you want, okay, which is to establish a shared memory region. Okay, in the first case, what you do is when you do shared memory get, this is like doing new or malloc. Okay. So you say, I need a piece of memory, just as you do when you do new or malloc. And then you say, it's a special type of memory. I want it to be a piece of memory that I can share with some other process. Okay, so think of it as a malloc, but you are trying to malloc shared memory region. Okay, so you get a piece of memory when this call returns, and there's a special piece of memory that the OS knows about. Okay, and then in the consumer process, you need to attach to it. Okay, so let's suppose the producer implements shared memory get, and then it basically gets a piece of memory. Okay, so the OS knows a shared memory, but at this point, the consumer hasn't actually attached itself to it. So then in the consumer, you have to then do shared memory attach and basically specify an ID of this of the shared memory segment and the process ID, and then what the OS is going to do is it's going to make this available to it. So it is as if the address space has been extended to include this region. Okay, so that's what the consumer looks at. So now both the producer and consumer processes can communicate or interact with each other using the shared memory region. Okay, is that clear? So let me just show you. Let's see. Right, so here is. So this is the call in C to do shared memory get. Right, so you basically specify the size, and then you have a key, and then you have some flag that says what is this readable, writable, and so on. Okay, so then this you get a shared memory region. Yeah. And this is shared memory attach. Right, so you basically, and then this is detach, which is just you detach yourself. So you can specify that shared memory address that you want to attach to, okay? And you specify an ID. So there has to be some way for the consumer to know what the producer has received in order for it to attach itself. Okay? Once you know that, you basically make this call and you attach yourself. Okay? Now there's another way to achieve this is using this notion of an M-map, which is what is called a memory map. Okay? So this basically allows you to map pages of memory. Okay, so what happens here, think of it as follows. Let's say there's a producer and consumer here. So by issuing an mmap call, what you can tell the operating system is take some pages or regions of memory from this process, okay, and then make it available to this other process. That's called memory mapping. Okay. So you basically do something to the memory management information within the OS kernel to make some of these pages visible here. So when the consumer actually accesses this region here, they are actually accessing this region. Okay. This is just a mapping. So when you access this, basically access this region. So this allows you to create a mapping. Okay. Of one process's pages to another process. That's basically what this call does. Okay. So here is an example. Okay, so here what you have done is you basically create an mmap of in and out. You can do the same thing for the buffer array as well using that call. That's a system call. Okay, what that tells the operating system is take the pages that where those variables are stored and share them. Okay. And then you are doing a fork. Okay. So it's assumed that if a memory map something and you do a fork, then any memory map region will also be available in the child process. Okay. So the child still has access to those same variables. Child doesn't get a copy of those variables, it actually accesses the original variables because it's the same pages. Okay, this is a little bit subtle, so you need to understand what I just said. Let me repeat what I said. First, create a memory map, okay, and then you do a fork here. Okay. Typically, when you do a fork, you take the parent process and you just create a mirror image of the parent process. So, if you hadn't done a memory map of in and out, you just get a copy of in and out. Okay, this is just a copy. So, if the parent process modifies in and out, the child process doesn't know anything about it. It has its own copy. That's not what you want. You want to be able to share the in and out variable. So, but if you created this M map and then you do a fork, this tells the operating system that those pages, you don't make a copy of those pages, but just share those same pages, exact same pages. So when the producer and the consumer access them, they are actually accessing the same physical page, not independent copies of those pages. Okay. This is how you create created an implicit shared memory. Okay, using shared memory get, you explicitly allocate a shared memory region and share it. This is how you have done it implicitly, saying these pages need to be shared, not copied. Yes, question.
Is that because the void pointer that gets returned from mmap is going to point to the same memory address in both the parent and child processes?
Is that because, meaning how?
Okay. Yeah.
So we have specified a flag called shared, right? So that's one thing.
Okay.
So once you say that, right? So let's. So here is what is happening. So this is the parent process. Okay. Then you say whatever those pages are that are in and out need to be shared. So you specify this mmap call. So these pages are now marked by the operating system, saying these are shared pages. So far nothing has happened, there is only one process because you haven't even done a fork. All you did is you took some of your memory pages and said these need to be shared, okay, because you specified. So now you go and do a fork. Okay. So when you do a fork, what the OS is going to do is it's going to create an exact copy of this process. Okay. If you hadn't done that mmap, these pages would also get copied here and you would get your own copy of these pages. But because you did the mmap, what would happen is at this address space, you would basically just have those same pages. Okay? So these pages are not going to be copies, but when you access this region of memory, your OS is actually going to transparently let you access this region,
that's
this page.
That flag that says that.
Yes.
Because if you just did a regular old MMAP, it would clone it.
Yeah, space. Exactly. Okay, is this clear? What has happened? So if you actually go back to, so you need to actually carefully read the man page to see what it says about fork and so on. Okay, just 1 second, let me actually show you what something looks like. I'll find it out. I think there was a note in there saying when you, what happens to mmap when you fork and what happens when you exec and so on, but that's fine. Okay. So that's how you create a shared memory region using mmap or shared memory get. Yes, your question there. Yes.
So how do you control, you know, when you use other memory from that page, you know, if you just need some other piece of memory that it doesn't use it from that shared area?
Yes, that's a good question. So how do you assume, so you have to be careful in how you set this up. You want to ensure that only variables you want to share are within that page. So when you do a allocation, that's where you have to take some care. You can't just arbitrarily, if you had only one integer there, okay, that you wanted to share, but that page contained other things, by doing this you are actually sharing everything in the page. So you don't want to inadvertently share things you don't want to share if you wanted to make copies of those. So you have to, as programmer, take care of all these issues.
I think it's map shared.
Yeah. Okay, so you're right. I mean, you should want to make sure those bad things were not going to happen. Those would be bugs, unintended bugs.
This is all in heap memory?
This is what?
This is all in the heap section.
Yeah, typically you want to do this on the heap, right? If you do it on a stack, you are in trouble. So you want to allocate a heap. So you want to allocate enough memory on the heap so it's one page in size. And then you want to do, and you want to only put that variable, shared variables in there and do this. And that's how it would work.
Okay, so you're saying with the mmap, wouldn't they put the variables automatically on the heap?
Mmap is not allocating memory.
Oh.
Mmap is just saying here is some allocated memory, just share it.
Okay.
Okay, mmap is not a memory allocate. If you want to allocate memory, you use one of these things. Okay. In mmap, you assume you will use new or malloc to actually allocate memory first, and this is just saying map it, meaning share it. That's all it is doing. It's not going to give you new memory.
So in this example, the in and out is still on the stack, it's on the main stack, right?
Yeah.
So you're sharing the memory that's on the stack.
No, so you don't want to share anything on the stack, right? So you probably want to first put in and out on the heap. So you would have allocated some memory and put them on the heap and then done this. Because if you do it from the stack, you may be in trouble. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so that's basically the end of our discussion on processes, and I'm going to switch to threads. But quick recap. So we said process is basically a program that's currently in execution. Okay. The state of the process is maintained by the OS kernel using the data structure called a process control block. There's one block for every process in the system that has all of the information that the kernel needs to know about that process. We talked about what are the states a process can be in, new, ready, waiting, running or terminated. We looked at what the transitions between these states look like. Okay. And then discussed this notion of a context switch, okay, where the OS suspends execution of a process and resumes execution of another one. Okay. And then I talked about process communicating with one another, cooperating processes, that is, using the notion of message passing or shared variables. Okay. So those were the set of topics we covered when we discussed processes. So now I'm going to switch gears and talk about threads. Okay, so I will introduce the notion of what a thread is. Okay. And then I'm going to talk about, since this is an OS class, right? So what we really want to know is, what does the OS need to do? Okay, even our process discussion was all about what is the OS doing as far as processes are concerned. So we'll see where should we implement threads, what's this notion of a kernel level threads, what are thread packages and so on. Okay. And if time permits, we'll start talking about scheduling both threads or processes. But more likely, we will defer this bullet to the next class, because I'm pretty sure we will run out of time by the time we are done talking about threads. Okay. So to understand the notion of a thread, you need to it's best to distinguish it with the notion of what a process is. Okay, I showed you a picture of what a process looks like. Okay, a process has some memory region, it has some segments that contain code, data, there's a stack segment, heap segment, and there's an execution context of the process, and that is basically the program counter, stack pointer and frame pointer that says what is the instruction this process is currently executing, okay, and what is its current stack frame that has the context of the current function. Okay. So to distinguish a thread from a process, think of the thread as basically extracting the execution context away from the process. So if you think of process as just the address space, it's just everything that's contained in memory, the thread is basically everything that you need to add execution context onto this process. Okay. Now, another way to think about it, so here is a picture just to distinguish between a thread and a process. Okay. This is what you have known so far as a process, which we will also distinguish as what's called a single threaded process. Okay. So that's the memory region of the registers in the stacks and all the files that are open and so on. This is the execution context. This is the instruction you're executing. Okay. Now to distinguish it from what we will call a thread, thread allows a process to have multiple execution contexts, okay, as is shown in this picture. Okay. So it's the same code, so same address space. Okay, there's a region in memory, there's code and data and so on, but there are multiple execution contexts, there are multiple things executing within this process. Each is called a thread of control. So this shows you three threads of controls that are interleaving themselves within the same process. Okay. Each thread of control has its own stack, has its own register, but they share the code segment, okay, as is shown here. Okay. So you could have multiple execution contexts within the same address space. Okay. These are called multiple threads being bound to a single process. Okay. So the address space is shared. Okay. And then we'll talk about system calls are not needed to cooperate. They can just share the address space. And we'll see how this allows these threads of control to communicate in a much simpler way than communicating between independent processes. Okay, so let me draw another picture just to show you what may be happening when you have a multi-threaded application. So let's say, let's call this an address space of some process. Okay? Let's look at the code segment. So there is main. Main has some code. Calls foo j. So that's the main program. Let's say there's a foo program. There's a bar. Okay. So let's say this is the code that's within the process. So in typically what you have when you think about a process is there is something that's executing some instruction of this process, and that is basically what the program counter is pointing to, and that's the execution context, and this program counter increments itself sequentially, and then when you make a function call it goes here and it executes the code in here, it comes back, it executes the next statement and so on. This is what you understand from a single threaded process or what you have just been calling a process. Okay. Now, if you have multiple threads of control within this process, there are multiple things executing different pieces of code within the same, what we call a process. So this could be thread 1. Okay, so this is PC for thread 1. Okay, then at the same time, something else, then another thread could be executing something else within this program. And you could have yet another thread that's executing something else. Okay. Each is an independent thread of control. Okay. Each looks does exactly what a sequentially executing process would do. Meaning this thread of control just keeps going sequentially. It may make function calls and so on. This thread of control is completely independent from this. This is executing this code and then it may return back here and so on. So these are three threads of control that are executing the process all at the same time. Okay. This is what we call a multi-threaded program. Or a process that has multiple threads of control. Okay. What is interesting to note is that they not only share this code segment, but any global data structures within this program are also shared. They are accessible to all these threads of control. Okay. If there is global variables here, this thread can access it. So let's suppose that there is an array here. All of these threads can access that array if it's a global variable. Okay, so you not only share data, I mean you not only share code, you also share data across these threads of control. Okay, each thread, just one thread, each thread has its own, as I showed you in this picture. Okay, so the address space is shared, which means code and data is shared, but each thread has its own stack. Okay, you clearly have to have your own stack because this thread may make a function call and it has its own stack frame. This has an independent stack, okay, and so on, as is shown in this picture. Each thread will have its own stack, but they will share the code and the data as is shown there. That is not replicated across the threads. Okay, you have a question here? Yes.
Does that apply for any heap allocation, not just global variables? Like if within, say, foo, there's an mmap to some local pointer that had been declared there, could the other threads access that mmap?
Yeah.
As long as it could somehow get to the pointer.
Yes. Okay. Anything that is within this process is accessible to any of these threads. Okay, exactly the way if this thread, there's some global variable it accesses, so can this thread. Because as far as the process is concerned, these all three threads are treated equally. Yeah, as if there's only a single thread. Okay, yes.
If each one can manipulate the data, then how do you know like which one gets to go first?
Yes, good question. So if each one can manipulate this data, how do you know that which one goes first and how do you ensure bad things don't happen? Right? You don't want to trample on each other's data. This is why you need synchronization. Okay? Just as you needed synchronization for processes that share a memory region, you will need synchronization here. Okay, so for example, you could implement producer-consumer using two threads within the same process instead of two independent processes. Okay, the buffer that we had shown in the previous set of slides, which was a shared memory region, just becomes a global array within the same process. This is your buffer. Okay, So the producer thread is just going to keep adding data items, and the consumer thread just accesses this array because it's a global data structure. Either of these threads can access it. Okay, there's no need to do anything special, and then you take data items out. But if you don't have synchronization, you may end up overwriting things and so on. Okay, so you need this notion of synchronization and locks and so on, which we will talk in the next chapter. Okay, rather two chapters from now. Okay, you do need all of that. Yes.
The diagram up there shows that each thread uses its own set of registers.
Yes.
But you only have a limited number of registers in your hardware. So what happens if you have a lot of threads and
Okay, that's a very good question. So what is shown here is each thread has its own stack and its own set of registers. So what happens if there are lots of threads? Will you have enough registers? That's the question, right? So think about this for just a second. Okay. So it should be clear why, first of all, you need your own set of registers. For the same reason that you need your own program counter. Okay? That you have your program counter here. This program counter is independent from that one. Okay, so you need to have your own program counter register, and so does this one. Okay. So now when this thread is executing, it may have stored some stuff in some variables. Some variables stored in registers. So that's the execution context of this thread. And this thread may have stored some other things in other registers. Okay, so you need to have your own independent set of registers. Now, what is not said here is not that these registers are not shared. Okay. What happens is if you have a uniprocessor system, only one thread can execute at any time. Just as only one process can execute at any time, only one of these could execute because these are independent execution context. So when this thread runs, you would load the registers that belong to that thread, you would load its program counter and it will execute. Just as you switch between processes, you can also switch between threads. So if this thread blocks on I/O or it uses up its quantum, it has to relinquish the processor. In which case, its registers and its program counters are stored somewhere. Just as you stored them in a process control block when you did a context switch, you do the same thing here. And then those registers would get loaded if this thread gets to go next. Right? So all this is showing a state of the registers. Not that there are 10 registers and you slice them up. Okay, it just says that when each thread runs, you load your register state and you run. And when you give up the CPU, you store it back somewhere in memory. Okay, yes, question.
So varying the cost, you said it was, what's the name for the amount of time that the process is allocated, the quantum time?
That's a quantum or a time slice, yes.
So during the time slice, it is then split into separate mini slices? And each thread is assigned that mini slice?
Yes, so that's a good question, right? So question is, if a process gets a time slice, then is that slice split into smaller slices and these threads are multiplexed on this slice? This will depend on whether, this is actually jumping a few slides, right? This depends on whether the presence of threads is known to the kernel or not. There's a notion of user level threads and there's a notion of kernel level threads. In kernel level threads, the OS knows about these threads. Okay? So it will not only pick a process, it will pick a thread from that process for execution. So it will give a time slice to a specific thread and not other threads. Okay? And then you don't need to do anything. You get a time slice as allocated saying that is the thread that's going to run. This process and that thread. Like process 10, thread 5 gets to run. That's what the scheduler would do. If you have user level threads, then the OS knows nothing about the presence of these threads. Okay? So what has to happen then is there has to be a threads library that's scheduling the threads. So the OS will pick a process. The threading library will then say, okay, the process gets to run now, which thread should run? So it will say, okay, let's pick that thread, and maybe it will have mini slices which says you can stop now and that runs and so on. Okay, so we'll come to that in just a minute. Any questions on this notion? Yes.
Is that true if you have like multi-processors, like let's say if you have like program with like two threads,
yep,
and you have two processors, well then
yes,
like I
yes,
mean then you really won't have like that
yes
slice, right?
Yes. So let me try to answer your question. If you have multiple processors or you have dual core machine, okay, you have two CPUs. So you could have two independent processes running at the same time. Yes, similarly you could have two of these threads running at the same time. Okay. Okay. So the same process is now executing on two processors. Okay, there's one thread running on the first processor and another thread running on the same processor. Same code runs in parallel. Okay, these threads cause the code to run in parallel. Okay. Now your question was, can, if you have user level threads, will the presence of multiple processors help or not? That's what you were asking, right?
Well, yeah, also like does the time slice kind of changes because because you're no longer like wanting to run a third after each other, you're running them at the same time.
So. Yes. So if you have multiple processors, the scheduler has to, if you have k processors in the system, the CPU scheduler has to pick k things to run, one on each of these processors. So it may pick k independent processes, or it may pick some number of threads from a process and run them in parallel. It can do whatever it wants. Okay? Yes, question there?
More questions. If this threading library is running in kernel space, is the scheduler shared between threads and processes?
Yes. The threading library runs in kernel space. What is called a schedulable entity is a execution context of a process. Okay, so essentially it's shared, it's shared between threads and processes.
Basically, it's saying, like, is it all in the same queue?
Yes.
So the processes treated, the threads treated as processes.
Yes. Effectively, threads are treated as schedulable entities. They have their own entry in the process control block in some sense.
Okay.
Right. So if you basically have two threads and they are kernel level threads,
right,
and one other process that has one thread, this process as a whole will run twice, get a twice as much CPU time as the other one, because you will schedule this thread and you will schedule that thread and you go to the next process.
And my other question was, can the presence of a lot of threads at one level skew the priority rankings of different processes? Like if a couple of processes have like 20 threads and the rest only have like one or two, are they going to end up getting more quanta versus the other threads at the same priority?
Yes. So basically, if you have multiple threads and the kernel knows about this thread, you get more CPU time.
So isn't that kind of a type of priority inversion almost?
Yes. So you basically are getting more CPU time than other processes. That it's assumed that is intentional, that you actually have a multi-threaded program because you wanted some notion of parallel execution. Okay, so you are the application designer, right? You probably wrote this thread to do something. So think of, a good example is Firefox or any web browser. What it does is, when you click on a link, it will go and fetch the HTML page. Okay, that just one thread goes and gets the page from the server. Now if this thread has multiple images, okay? Alarm thing is not switched off. Okay. So if this page has multiple images, then what would happen is Firefox would start some number of threads and each thread would then start fetching these images in parallel. Okay, so thread one goes, gets the first image, thread goes. If you did this sequentially, it will take a long time for your page to load. You get the first image, then you wait for the second image to load, you get the third image to load. You don't want that. You want your page to load fast. So then you just spawn off some number of threads. Each goes and gets these images in parallel and they all load at the same time. Okay, this basically means that your browser at this point is getting more resources from the system because you're trying to parallelize work. And the assumption is it was intentional. You want pages to load faster. That's why you did this.
But it can be abused.
Yeah. So you can abuse it by starting a large number of threads and taking a disproportionately large CPU time. So there is nothing that prevents you from doing that. Okay. All right. So this is just gives you a quick overview of what various operating systems look like from the notion of processes and addresses, rather processes and threads. So the simplest model for process and thread is what was in the MS-DOS system. In DOS, there was just one process and one thread of control. There was no notion of multiple processes at all. It could only run one program at one time. And that program could have only one thread of control. That's what is shown in this picture. Okay. In any more sophisticated operating system, you can run multiple processes at once. You know that, right? That is what is shown in this picture. Here, you have multiple processes running, but there is no threading support. So each process has a single thread of control. This is what you know as a process. Okay, so you can run multiple processes in any flavor of Unix. These are old flavors of Unix and Ultric. Multiple processes, each has one thread of control. Okay, this is any modern operating system. Okay, anything today allows you to run not only a multiple processes, but each process can have multiple threads in them. Okay, that's what is shown. This process has two threads and this has three. This is a typical single threaded process. This has two and so on. Okay. So, single process, single thread of control, nothing else you can run there. Multiple processes, but each is a traditional process. Multiple processes, but each process can be multi-threaded. Okay, these are three variants of what operating systems can support. That's also the evolution of operating systems. This is what used to be done in the old days. That's what used to be done sort of 10, 20 years ago. This is what you do now. Okay. Now, if you have embedded operating system, let's say if you look at Palm OS, right, the operating system that Palm uses, okay, it has this model. It only supports one process at a time, okay, but it allows multiple threads to run within that process. So everything is one global address space. Any process can access anything that is in memory, but you can have multiple threads. Okay, but you don't have the notion of more than one process. Okay, so this is somewhere between here and here. Okay, you can have multi-threaded stuff, but everything just executes within one address space. There is no memory protection. Any thread that is executing, let's say, on a device like Palm can access anything in memory. Okay, is that clear? So these are the various models that you can think of when you see the evolution. Okay, here's an example of a multi-threaded producer-consumer program. So that's the main program. It basically forks two threads. Okay? Fork thread is not a real call. This is a pseudocode. Okay? I'll show you how to actually create threads in using various threads library in a few slides. But assume for now fork thread just creates a thread. Okay? So what you do is you say fork that thread and have it execute the producer function. So that thread is going to execute here. And then the second thread is going to execute the consumer function. Okay? So now in this case, buffer is, so you are basically, think of this as equivalent to our shared memory version of producer consumer, except that you don't need to do anything special for the buffer. You just declare them to be global variables. In is a global variable, out is a global variable, the buffer is a global array. Okay, so both of these threads can access it, okay, just as they access any global variable. So all this producer is doing is it produces an item, it stores it in the next slot in the array, okay, at the head of the array, and the consumer is just consuming data items from the tail of the array, and you are done. Okay, no need to do anything special, no memory map, no nothing. Everything is just available to you. Anything that's a global variable is available to you. And this thread of control is always independent. So this runs and it produces data items, and then this thread is going to run. Okay, and consume data items, and they just run in parallel. Is this clear? Any questions here? Okay, now the picture here is showing you what these threads are doing. Okay, so this code is now shared across the two threads. So each thread has its own program counter. The first thread is actually executing its program counter, just loops here. The second thread has its program counter looping in here. That's what is shown here. Okay. Each thread has to have its own stack. Okay. As I said that each thread has its own stack. So this, the producer is a function. So it has its own stack which has main and producer. And this thread has its own stack which the stack frame would be the main function and the consumer. Okay. That's also shown in this picture. There's one thread stack here and another thread stack here. The heap is shared and so are global variables. They don't get a separate heap. Heap is always shared across the entire address space. And if you had more threads, the same thing would be true. There would be multiple stacks, the heap would be shared and the code segment would be shared. Yes?
Your while loop doesn't make sense. It's like while n plus 1 mod n equals out.
Oh, which while loop are you talking about? Is this clear? What we have just, how we have implemented producers and consumers using threads. Okay, so I showed you three variants so far. One was multi-process producer and consumer. They're independent processes. One is a producer, one is a consumer, shared memory region. Then there was independent processes that communicate using message passing. This is a multi-threaded version of producer-consumer. Again, none of these will actually work without synchronization. So I haven't shown you anything about synchronization. Yeah, but you need to imply synchronization to get it to work right. Okay. So now let's come back to this notion of kernel level threads and user level threads and try to understand them in more detail. Okay. So I already mentioned what a kernel level thread is. This is a thread that the kernel knows about. It can actually see that a certain process has 5 threads. The kernel actually knows that how many threads are present within the process. Okay. Not only does the kernel know about them, it gets to schedule these threads. It not only gets to pick which process gets to run next, it also gets to pick which thread within that process gets to run next. Okay. So in other words, in kernel level threads are schedulable entities. These are entities that can be explicitly scheduled by the kernel to run on the CPU. Okay. Now, I didn't mention this notion of a context switch. So when you have kernel level threads of the same process and you are switching between threads, you again have a context switch. This context switch is similar to the context switch between processes that I talked about last time. Okay, remember when I said your time, when a time slice of a process expires, runs out, then you have to suspend execution of this process, save the state of that process, meaning you take its program counter, all of its stack pointer, all of its registers, dump them into the process control block. Okay? And you pick another process to run. Okay? And you look, take all of its state and load them into the register. You look at this process control block, take the program counter that was stored there, load it into the PC register, take all the remaining ones, load them, and then you get to run. Okay? This is what is involved when you do context switch between processes. Okay? Similarly, when you switch from one thread to another, let's for now assume you are switching from one thread to another and they belong to the same process, you also have to do a context switch. Okay? But this context switch is cheaper than a context switch between processes. Okay? Context switching between threads is cheaper than context switching between processes. Why is that? Yes.
But isn't I.O. kind of like a, once you have to perform I.O., isn't that just the cost of the operation, no matter how much I.O. you're performing?
Yeah, the context switch overhead doesn't include any I.O. operation. Context switch is just the set of tasks you have to do to take the register, store them somewhere, so you can get back to them later, and load the state of new registers. Okay. The reason context switch between threads is cheaper is when you switch, let's say, from thread 1 to thread 3 here, it's still the same address space. Okay, the address space hasn't changed. So you don't have to store memory management information out. That doesn't need to be swapped out. Because its page tables and so on are also part of the context of a process. You're switching between processes, you're not only saving the values of registers, you're also saving all of the memory management information, which is where in memory does this process reside. All of that is also swapped out. And then you swap in the same information for the new process. When you switch between one thread to the next within the same process, the memory management information does not change because the entire memory region is shared by all of the threads. So the only thing you have to do is swap out these registers and swap a new set of registers. That is much cheaper than doing a full context switch. Okay? Is that clear? So this is why we claim, as is mentioned here, that switching between kernel threads of the same process requires a small context switch. Okay, the values of the registers, program counter and the stack pointer must be same, but memory management information does not need to be changed. Okay. Now if you are switching between two kernel threads and these two threads belong to two different processes, not the same process, then what? So I said if you are switching between two kernel threads of the same process, that's cheaper than switching between two independent processes. But suppose you are switching between two threads, but these threads belong to two different processes, then what would be the case?
Then
from a context-rich perspective. Question clear or not? Yes. Switching between two threads that belong to different processes is no different but as switching between processes, because you have to save, you are changing address spaces. You have to save not only register values but all of the memory management information, because the other process has different information, and then you switch. Okay. So when I say context switching between threads is cheaper, there's an implicit assumption that you are switching between threads of the same process. Okay. Switching between threads of different processes is no different from switching between two processes, because you have to do the same set of steps. Okay. Okay. So in kernel level threads, as I already mentioned this, the scheduler not only has to now decide between between which processes to run, but also has to pick threads, okay, of the processes. Okay, again, this statement says switching between threads is faster. This is switching between threads of the same process. Okay, that's the thing to keep in mind. So don't get confused there. Okay. Now let's flip sort of to the next slide and look at user level threads. Okay. So as the name suggests, a user level thread is a thread that the OS knows nothing about. Okay. As far as the OS is concerned, it only sees a process. And it thinks that it's basically a single threaded process. Okay. But it's not really a single threaded process. There are multiple threads in that process. The OS just doesn't know about them. Okay. So it treats this process as if it was a single threaded process. Okay. So the OS only knows about the process but not the threads. And it schedules the process, but it doesn't schedule the threads within the process. So the only thing the OS can do is say this process gets to run. It doesn't even know that it has multiple threads, so it cannot obviously pick which thread to run. So something else has to decide when the process runs which thread gets to run. Okay? So that is done by a threads library. Okay? So the threads library knows about the creation of threads and it knows how many threads exist in this process. Okay? The notion of the thread has not changed. It's just whether the kernel knows about them or not. It's the same notion. The threads do exactly what kernel level threads do, except that in one case the OS knows about them, in the other case it doesn't. So the kernel is only going to pick which process runs to run next, and then the threads library has to pick one of these threads to run. Okay? And then it has to decide how to switch between threads, because once you get a time slice, you would have to have this notion of smaller slices and swap or switch threads. Okay, within the process. Yes.
With respect to the thread, user level threads, since the kernel doesn't know about that, know that it's executing threads, it won't. Will it not give it a larger time slice? It will still maintain normal time slice.
Right. So as far as time slices are concerned, let's assume everybody gets the same time slice. So Linux uses, let's say, it uses a 200 millisecond time slice. This is independent of whether it's a single threaded program, multi-threaded program, and so on. Okay, so you might have a single threaded program, you might have, let's call it process 1, and then there is this process 2, this thread 1 and thread 2 within that process. When any of these get to run, they all get the same time slice. It's not like you say this is a thread, so I'm going to give it a smaller time slice. So the scheduler doesn't distinguish. It basically just schedules whatever is on the run queue, or ready queue rather, just picks that and it just schedules it and it gives it a time slice. It may so happen that it is a thread within a process or an independent process with only one thread. Okay. Now in this case, it doesn't even know. So it is also, this process is also going to get the same time slice. Okay. So in some sense, having user level threads from a scheduling perspective is a little bit inferior, because These are kernel level threads. There are two threads here. These will get to run twice as much. This will get twice as much CPU time as this process. If this process had two user level threads, they are not going to get as much time slice, because this only gets to run once, and then it goes back to the end of the queue, because the kernel doesn't know about the present. Okay, there were some hands here. Yes.
Does this mean that there's always going to be at least two threads running in the user level system? One for scheduling and one for running
their program. Yes. So if you have a user level threads library, there always has to be a thread manager. Okay. that's its own thread. Okay, and then there are actual user level threads within that process. So whenever the process gets to run, the thread manager, think of this as the thread scheduler. The thread scheduler, so this gets to run, and then this is this, I'll pick one of these threads to run. So the thread scheduler needs to do exactly what the OS kernel scheduler does. It has to have its own ready queue, saying which of these user level threads are ready to run, and then it needs to pick one, needs to schedule them, it needs to context switch them. Everything that the kernel scheduler did, you're implementing in a user level thread library as a thread scheduler.
So it's not typically implemented by some sort of shared process that controls
it. No, it's not shared process. Each, so if you have another process that has its own threads library, it would have also its own thread scheduler. Okay, because this is just a library. Every process that makes use of this package or this library will have a thread that's implementing a scheduler for those set of threads. Okay? Yes, question.
What's the cost of context switching in a user level thread library? I mean, if it's between threads within a user level thread library, whatever, but if it's between that and some other process, would it be a larger penalty than between kernel level, in between the kernel queue?
Right. So, question about context switching user level thread, that's coming right here. So let me just show this picture and then we'll just come to your question. Okay. So here is a picture of what are, these are kernel schedulable entities. And the kernel only sees this one blob, it just thinks it's a process. But as you see, inside the process there are multiple threads. There's a thread ready queue for each of these processes. There's a thread level scheduler. It's a typo there. So that's a thread level scheduler that decides which of those to run and so on. Okay. Now you may ask, why do you want to implement a user level threads library? It looks like kernel level threads do better because kernel knows about them and it can schedule them and so on. So we look at advantages and disadvantages. Okay, when do user level threads library get you something that's more beneficial? Okay. Now, it's interesting thing about user level threads is that from a kernel perspective, there's no context switch over it to switch between one thread to another. So switching between user level threads is very cheap. It's basically the cost of a function call. Okay, because all that you have done is that this process is running, this schedule function runs, it just takes the thread that was running, it just stores its register somewhere and it loads the next set of registers. But the process continues to run. Okay? In case of any kernel level context switch, this entire process has to be suspended. Okay? And then the kernel, you have to track to the kernel. The kernel has to run. Okay, it has to pick the and save all the state of these registers and then load the next set of registers and then resume execution of another process. That is a lot more expensive. Okay, suspending a process, executing a trap, is, as you can imagine, is a lot more expensive than just making a function call. Because this is a library, it's linked to the application. You just call the schedule function. Okay, that's a function call. It just picks the next thread. It does all the bookkeeping to say the state of the thread and it runs. Okay? So similarly, thread creation and thread deletions are also very cheap, okay, because the kernel is not involved in any of this. Okay, in the previous case, when you create a new thread, it's actually a system call because the kernel needs to know about these threads. You have to go to the kernel and say, I'm a process, I need a new thread. Okay, then the kernel creates a thread for you. It allocates space in the process control block to save the state of that thread and all of that. Okay. So, user level, in other words, user level threads are lot more efficient and faster than kernel level threads from the perspective of context switching, from the perspective of thread creation and deletions. Okay. Also, it's more flexible because different processes on the same system can use different user level threads libraries. Okay? When you choose a kernel level threads package, the scheduling algorithm is something that is already implemented in the kernel. You can't change it. All processes that make use of kernel level threads have to use the same scheduling algorithm. Okay? That's not the same for user level threads. In user level threads, you can have two processes on the same system, but one makes use of library 1, the other makes use of library 2. They may implement different scheduling policies. Okay, that is most appropriate for that program. So you can pick and choose. Okay, you can pick the library that works best for you. one may do round robin, the other one may do something else, a prioritized user level threads scheduler, and you just pick the right one, okay, for you. So this allows you to make more flexible decisions from an application standpoint. Okay, and you don't, as I already mentioned, you don't need system calls. Okay, so these are much faster in kernel level. So let me just do the disadvantages so there's no gap and then we can adjourn for the day. The disadvantages, okay, the advantages of kernel level threads become disadvantages here and vice versa. Since the OS does not know anything about the presence of these threads, it may make poor scheduling decisions. Okay, there may be a user level threads application with 100 threads, okay, and then maybe another process that single thread, both get the same amount of CPU time. Because the kernel doesn't know anything about them, it's going to run process 1, then going to run process 2. Process 2 has 100 threads, it doesn't know about them. So it just gives it the same CPU time as it gives to a single threaded process. If you had kernel level threads instead, then a process with 100 kernel level threads will get 100 times the CPU time as one with a single thread. Because it knows that there are 100 things to schedule and it will give it more CPU time. Okay? So in other words, basically you the scheduling decisions from a kernel standpoint are poor, you will not get more CPU time by automatically. Okay? The other problem is in user level threads, if one thread blocks, everything blocks. Okay? If any one of these threads makes a system call, the entire process blocks even if the other 99 threads are ready to run. Okay, again, this is because the system doesn't know about the presence of these threads. It just thinks this is a single threaded process. Okay. So if there's a system call, it suspends this process and puts it onto the wait queue. Because it doesn't know there are other threads in the system. Okay, so there may be other threads ready to run, but if any one of them makes a blocking I/O call, the whole process is going to block and go onto the wait queue. This is not true for kernel level thread, because then kernel level thread, only that thread can go onto the wait queue, the others will still stay in the ready queue and get to run while one thread is blocked. Okay, that's a very important distinction. Yes.
What about with multi-core?
Yes. Even with multi-core in user level threads, you get no benefit because the problem is you don't know there are threads in the process. Right? You just, from your perspective, this looks like a single-threaded process. Mm-hmm. The presence of threads is invisible to the kernel. So one, that process blocks, it just goes to the wait queue because you don't know anything what is in the process. Okay, so it doesn't matter how many processors there are on the system. Okay. So let's just stop here and we'll resume the discussion next time.